You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello and welcome to the 16th edition of your favorite podcast, A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. My name's Maka, and at the other end of this very long cord is my best friend, Matt. Good morning, Matt. How are you?
Hello, I'm fine. I'm slightly under-caffeinated. I just had one very big coffee, but somehow one is not a good number, you know? One is the loneliest number when it comes to coffee.
It is, yeah. Coffee should always come in twos.
At the very least, yeah.
Like evil twins, yes.
How are you doing?
I'm okay, thanks. I think the fog is getting to me, but I won't let it. What have you seen? What have you done? What have you done? Sorry.
I still know what you did last October. Yeah.
What have you watched or read that you would like to talk about?
There's quite a few things, surprisingly. For one thing, this week and last week, I got two new comics. I really enjoy, for instance, Saga by Brian K. Vaughan, and the latest issue of that one came out, which I really enjoyed, but can't really talk much about it because otherwise we would fill several episodes. Same with The Wicked and the Damned. Is it Wicked and the Damned? No, The Wicked and the Divine, which also just came out, really enjoying it, but again, way too much material. I just got started on the BBC adaptation of China Meyerville's The City and the City, but we've just seen one episode, so I can't tell you much about that just yet. So what I really would like to talk about is one of my moments in virtual reality. I'm not sure whether I've mentioned virtual reality before on the podcast. I've definitely blogged about it. Specifically, I wanted to talk about just a moment in this game called Hellblade, Senua's Sacrifice. I've definitely blogged about that once or twice.
Yeah.
It's an action-adventure set in a kind of semi-historical, semi-mythical time where you have the Celts, the Picts, the Norsemen, and the main character is a young woman who suffers from psychosis, who hears voices, who sees faces and signs in the world, and who basically tries to come to terms with the trauma she's experienced, the death she's experienced, and the loss she's had. And there's a virtual reality version of that. Now, virtual reality is an odd beast in that some game types work really well in it, others not so much. This game is a third-person action-adventure. That means you always look at the character you're playing, which might be a weird fit for virtual reality. You'd think virtual reality is about, you know, being the character, being the camera. You look around as the person you are.
Yeah.
In this case, not. You're always looking at Senua. And some of the things that virtual reality does really well, one of them is scale. On a computer screen, things are as big or as small as the screen, basically. But you don't relate that to yourself. You have a big screen, obviously things are big. You have a small screen, obviously things are small. But you don't think of it in terms of that person is as big as I am. That house is 10 times as big as I am.
Yeah.
In virtual reality, that is completely different. You look up at things, literally. You look down at things, literally. You are part of the scale, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And Senua in this game, she's human-sized, and that sounds very banal, but for a computer game, that is something that changes things so much in terms of how you relate to what you're seeing on screen.
Yeah.
If there's a human next to you, you think about that human being differently. Mm-hmm. Cognitively, there's a difference there. Emotionally, there's a difference there. And the way you take in Senua when she's your size, when you're sitting right behind her in a kind of roughly hewn canoe, it's totally different from seeing the same thing on the screen. But the moment that really, really struck me was, as I said, she hears voices. You also hear the voices that she hears. And at some point, she turns around to face the voices and she looks at you. She looks you straight in the eye. You know, you sometimes have these moments in films where someone looks straight at the camera. It's always kind of a strange moment.
Mm-hmm.
It breaks the fourth wall. But at the same time, it's also kind of an artificial moment, because even though they're looking at the camera, you don't quite have the impression they're looking at you. You just know that that's what they're signaling. You know, depending on where you sit with vis-a-vis the screen, they look past you. Depending on where you sit vis-a-vis the screen, you realize they're just a flat 2D image anyway. It's not exactly the same as having a person standing in front of you and looking you in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
In virtual reality, when done well, and in this case it was done well, I stood there, or I felt I stood there, And Senua was looking at me. She was taking me in. She was recognizing me as one of her voices, as another being, which also meant that I took her in as a real person.
Yeah.
And I've never had a moment like that in games. It reminded me that I think sometimes games are actually less close to film, even though they steal a lot of technique from cinema, but they're closer actually to theater. I mean, imagine you're in a small theater, front row, the main character comes on stage, and then the main character looks at you and starts talking to you. That is an inherently different feeling,
yeah.
A very different experience from a movie where someone looks at the camera.
Mm-hmm.
It's a much more intimate, almost potentially intrusive moment. And virtual reality can do that. And as I said, that was just a 1 minute moment in this game early on. There's plenty of other things it does interestingly and it does well, but that one moment made me think, wow, this medium can engage us in a way that completely bypasses all of our, you know, this is fiction, this is not real, it's just pixels, it's just a screen.
Mm-hmm.
And make us engage the way that we would engage with a human being in front of us. Of course, there's always limitations. And, you know, it's not like I could then talk to Senua and she would answer like a regular human being. But just that moment of eye contact,
mm-hmm.
I thought was really, really striking and powerful. And I'm looking forward to seeing what other similar moments virtual reality will come up with.
That sounds really fascinating. Wow. Maybe I should give VR a go at some point. You know? I've never done it. I'm sort of hesitant when it comes to video games, computer games.
I think at some point, perhaps you have to come over and then I'm going to introduce you to the wonders of virtual reality.
Yeah.
And if you're lucky, you're not going to spend the next 2 hours throwing up violently.
Why would that happen?
It actually seems to happen to quite a few people that virtual reality makes people experience something a bit akin to seasickness.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're in virtual reality and you're walking around in the virtual space, that's fine. But if you move in the virtual space, but your body is still, your body tells your brain, hang on, something is deeply, deeply wrong. And then the brain says, you're right, something is wrong. Let's throw up. It doesn't happen to me, thank God, but I've heard about lots of people who have basically said virtual reality is not ready for the big time. Because it makes them violently sick.
Okay.
So you might be one of those people, or you might be lucky.
That sounds like an astronaut's training or something.
Exactly. We're all like John Glenn. We have the right stuff.
I think one of these days I'm going to take you up on that offer, yeah.
Very good. How about you? Have you had any weird eye contacts in popular culture?
Not so much about eye contact. You know, we're going to a little island called Utoya later for the second time in a row. And I wanted to mention something positive, something comedic, something funny, something to laugh about. But I've watched something about a week ago that I really, really have to tell people about. It's called a documentary. It's called The Cleaners. Mm-hmm. It's done by two German filmmakers who have a background in art, in video art. This is their first proper documentary at feature length. It's almost 90 minutes long, normal length for a documentary. The Cleaners is about the so-called content moderators. Most of them are stationed in Manila. That's where all the questionable images and videos from Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and whatnot end up. And those content moderators, they have to decide in the blink of an eye whether an image or a video is suitable or not for the internet. There are strict rules. There are very complicated and strict rules in place. And these guys, they have to decide within seconds whether to delete or to ignore. Ignore means it stays on the internet.
Yeah.
And the documentary is about four or five of them. They have all quit. No one still employed there was ready to talk on camera about their experiences. So they've all quit. They have either quit because they wanted to or they were fired. My impression is you don't do that kind of work for very long because Your objective for the day is to decide 25,000 times whether an image should stay on the internet or not. And that's a quota that's just impossible to attain. You can't do it. Do the math and you realize it's just nuts to ask that of a person, even if that person is doing a 12-hour shift. And yeah. if you also know that a 12-hour shift consists of watching images of violence, beheadings, pornography, slander, I think even full frontal nudity is one of the lighter cases you will have to judge. There are people who have huge, huge mental and psychological problems because of that job. I think that company, it's not proper Facebook. Facebook and all the other Silicon Valley greats have outsourced that work to Manila. And Manila is where all the European and American images are judged, whether they're fit for publication or not. So those are mostly Filipinas and Filipinos doing that kind of work. And there is at least one young woman whose mother told her, look, you can either do that job or you can end up jobless. In the worst case, you can become one of those trash people who try to find a few cents an hour in a huge trash heap and everything. Mm-hmm. If you want to do the work on the trash heap, fine. But this is Facebook. Go work for them. Then you have a future. And I thought, it's so goddamn bleak. You either work on a rubbish tip in an environment that's dirty, smelly, and possibly lethal, or you go work and look at images that just insult you 25,000 times a day. You have to judge whether a beheading is of historical value or whether it's just sensationalism, and you have to do that within 2 or 3 seconds.
I mean, in some ways, I think it's a different rubbish heap, one that's less immediately physically dangerous, but emotionally, psychologically. And I mean, what I would imagine is you just get the images. It's completely decontextualized. I don't know, perhaps you have the posts sometimes, but it's still, it's basically you've got horrors thrown at you many, many, many times a minute. And just what does the brain do with that? I think already if the horror is contextualized, it's dramatic. I remember, I think about 10 years ago, one of the magazines I read, they had, I think, an entire edition about, I can't remember, I think it was about pictures and what pictures do to you, us, photos. And they had an image in there of a young woman who was a suicide bomber. And basically, I mean, this is pretty gruesome, so please fast forward, those of you who don't want to hear any of the details. The blast of the bomb had basically decapitated her, and her head was lying there. They warned us in that publication that this is coming. You may not want to look at this. You may want to kind of go forward. They then tried to make a point for why such images, why it can be justified to show such images. So it was all contextualized. It was part of a discussion. Even like that, I thought, this is tough. And it is perhaps too tough. It perhaps goes too far. You know, not even talking about questions such as ethics, is one allowed to show that or not? But just personally, some people will look at that image and it will leave traces. It should leave traces, but they're traces that you may or may not get rid of. And if that already happens with one image, clearly contextualized, clearly discussed, embedded in something that I think softens the blow to some extent, I can only imagine how much trauma that must do if you've just got image after image after image with none of that context.
Yeah, it's true. There are two young women who are sort of, you can see that they have huge problems doing that job, but there is some kind of pride, not because they can withstand the horrors they have to see every day, but because they say, we are some sort of line of defense. We're doing that for you. We are some sort of protectors. It's true what they say, but it's so, it's thankless. They probably have a very low wage, and there is no psychological backup. There is no office where you can go, sit down, close the door behind you, and talk to some kind of therapist where you can say, you know, I need a minute. I can't do it. I need a break. Can I talk to you for a second? There's nothing like that. You are just told a few things when you start a job, what's allowed and what's not allowed, very technical, very administrative stuff. And then they tell you, you can make three mistakes. A mistake would be leaving a problematic image on the internet or erasing an image that would actually be within the guidelines. If they catch you more than three times, you're out. That's the most crucial thing they offer you. They don't offer you any kind of psychological help or anything, nothing. There is no one coming to you and asking, are you okay? Is it going fine? Do you need help? Can I bring you a glass of water? Nothing. They just sit there and do their jobs. And it's horrifying.
I think it very much fits the logic of capitalism, to go political for a moment. I think on the surface, social media like Facebook, they will say, yes, we want to take on the responsibility of making sure that such images are not posted. They package this as an ethical service towards the community, right?
Yeah.
I think really what's at bottom here is they don't want to be sued. So they feel they have to do that. Fair enough. You know, companies work differently than individuals. And of course, if you've got, you know, if you're a for-profit company, you're going to look at the bottom line. So I have some understanding that they're trying to do this in a way that costs them as little as possible, but not at the price of traumatizing the people that are doing the work for them. I think a minimum of ethics is what I would expect. And especially since they kind of present the whole thing to the world as this is an ethical service for you, it makes it all the more shitty, I would say. Sorry, I can't use a less strong word than that. I have a couple of stronger words that I would like to use. So, I mean, from what you've just said, it's definitely an interesting and an important topic. But what was it like as a film, that documentary?
It was, they sort of restaged the working situation on another story of the building, but in the same building that the actual work is done. They put up cubicles where the people work, and the people were able to sort of replicate the working situation as much as possible. Some people are able to talk about the work clinically on camera, almost emotionless. You know, on the left-hand side, we can see a body, and on the left-hand side, there's the decapitated head of that thing. Things like that, completely compartmentalizing. Others are no longer able to make one grammatically complete sentence because their nerves are completely frayed. They probably were barely ready to talk on camera. As I said, all of them don't work any longer for that company. But they also talk about at least one person who asked for transfers many times, and then because the transfer wasn't granted, he committed suicide. That was it. Couldn't take it anymore. So the worst has already happened. The movie is, it's talking heads. It's showing those talking heads not talking, but working on a screen. There are a few images non-pixelated. There is at least one beheading, I think. There is no hardcore pornography, I think. But because the two directors, both German, because they have a background in video art, they use computer graphics to great effect. It looks like some kind of 3D version of The Matrix. Remember The Matrix when those numbers, you know, sort of float over the screen from the top down to the bottom? They do a cityscape with the data going upwards, like a rising landscape or a rising cityscape. It looks stunning. It looks great. But the better it looks, the more of a counterpoint it is to that, those soul-crushing messages that they can no longer do their jobs, those persons.
It seems a bit of an odd choice. I mean, I like my documentaries to also have certain cinematic ambitions. But from what you've just said, it sounds like, in a way, the aesthetic appeal of how it's presented almost overrides what is being said. And that to me, it sounds like they might have wanted to put that energy into a music video rather than into this documentary.
No, it's not. I don't think the graphics are overpowering. They're beautiful to look at, but they're they're slow. They're always pitted behind in front of a completely black background. Mm-hmm. That works. I think it works. And it's not easy to sort of visualize the internet. You know, it would have been wrong to use a camera following some kind of cable through the network and stuff like that. You know, it's been overdone. It's been done to death. That would have been a wrong choice. Those rising cityscapes, they sort of work, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think once they can pixelate the graphic images, they should show that stuff at school. I think you should show that to 15, 16-year-olds because they all have cell phones. They all will be confronted with images like that sooner or later, and they have to know what the internet is and what it does and what it can't do and how people like Mark Zuckerberg think and act. The film ends with Mark Zuckerberg saying, "Let's make the internet better one day at a time." And I thought, yes, you have a titanic task in front of you, pal. It's not your fault, but go ahead, you know. Yeah, on that happy note.
Exactly. Well, as you've already said, we are, as Jack in Lost might have said, we have to return to the island.
Oh, Jack in Lost, yeah.
This episode is actually kind of a first in, what did you say? This is episode 16, right? So it's kind of a first in terms of it's the first direct sequel, so to speak, to an earlier episode. For those of you who have listened to last month's episode, which was on Utøya, July 22nd, the Norwegian film by Erik Poppe, you remember that we also briefly talked about that there was another film about the Utøya massacre, an American film by the English director Paul Greengrass. And back then I said, I'm not sure I want to watch it. I'm not sure I need a second Utøya film in the next couple of months. What happened then was, of course, that it premiered on Netflix. It's right there for our taking. To some extent, I felt that, you know, if we're serious about this, we almost have to watch the second film just to be able to talk about it, to compare them, because, well, I think to some extent we also look ourselves as critics, as cultural critics. And I think in order to do that job properly, not that we're being paid for it, but other than in, you know, the admiration of our fans, I think we ought to also, you know, see what others do with the same material and how that works, how they perhaps are complementary, how they perhaps do completely different things. I wasn't looking forward to it, but I realized that I was less resistant to the idea of watching Paul Greengrass's film, which is just entitled 22nd of July. And thanks to it being on Netflix, I also didn't have to think about, you know, do I really want to see this at the cinema where you basically have no way of escaping what's on the screen? As a reminder to those of you who either didn't listen to last month's podcast or don't remember everything that we said, perhaps we can just quickly say what we said about the Erik Poppe attempt at interpreting the Utøya massacre on film. If I remember correctly, Maggie, you liked it better, right?
I did, yeah. I liked the claustrophobia. I liked the real-time aspect of it. I liked the witness angle of it.
Exactly. I also would say I appreciated those things. I thought that the film did what it sets out to do probably almost as well as can be done. It is. It feels very documentary. It feels very immediate. It definitely does not downplay the horror at all. What I felt was that some of the things it actually did well, like, for instance, it never shows Breivik, the guy who committed this crime. It didn't give him any screen time. I thought, on the one hand, that's a good decision. You don't want to give someone who probably wanted to be in the newspapers, wanted to be on TV screens and wants to be in the movies, who thinks this is a certain kind of weird, sick heroism. You don't want to give that person screen time. And I like that Utøya July 22nd didn't do that. But at the same time, I felt that because it strips what happens on Utøya of its context, in decontextualizing it, I think it also depoliticizes it, and that is something I take issue with. My problem with Erik Poppe's film was really that I felt, what's the point of this? Does it become anything more than basically a kind of dire, grim cinema vérité horror movie, and I still have exactly those doubts. I have to say, though, that having watched the Paul Greengrass movie, I think I've come to appreciate Eric Popper's movie more. Perhaps just very, very briefly, what did you think of 22nd of July? Did you like it? Did you dislike it? Or do other adjectives come to mind?
It played it too safe for me. It was too procedural for me. It was almost too... No, it was by the numbers, basically. It was well made. It was well acted most of the time. But there was a complete lack of surprise. Whenever I thought, oh, well, now we could have the main guy struggling with his fate because this and that, and now he's going to exercise in order to take the stand. And he did exactly that. There was no real surprise. It's about 2.5 hours long, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And it ticks boxes one after the other in the right order. There was nothing where I thought, oh, okay, that's new. Wow, well done. It mm-hmm. is well done, but it didn't anything new or courageous or special or even innovative. Greengrass is very good at action scenes, but even the action scenes are done well and expertly, but not more. There is nothing that I thought, wow, I have to tell Matt about this, you know.
Yeah.
Nothing at all. And mm-hmm. and at the same time, it also doesn't have any, it sounds very weird, but it doesn't have too much empathy for any of its players. It's always at such a weird distance. Even the attorney who represents Breivik, he's called Geir Lieberstadt, I think. He could have a small speech what he thinks about Breivik at some point towards the end. He doesn't. He just gives him a look, refuses to shake his hand, and then leaves the room. No. I mean, the Greengrass movie tries to be political and to take sides, but it sort of half fails. I don't know whether I'm explaining this enough. What did you think about it?
I think I can be a bit stronger in what I feel about it. I would say I hated it.
Mm-hmm.
I have to qualify that a bit, but actually it's not much of a qualification. I wouldn't quite agree with you that it's well done. I think it's competently done, but I also think it's mediocre. It's generic. It's bland. You said it ticks boxes, and I think it absolutely does. It ticks mm-hmm. boxes, and it ticks boxes coming out of kind of crime/political thriller. It feels like a genre movie, and it feels like a generic genre movie it feels like an okay TV movie. There's no passion there. There's no risk there.
Mm-hmm.
It's by the numbers completely. And yeah. I think that's why, you know, usually I would say a mediocre film is a mediocre film. Take it or leave it. If you like the genre, you might like it. Whatever. I think a film about this can take risks and fail. I'm okay with that. A film about this can be extremely passionate and go overboard in it. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with that. If a film about this is mediocre and competent and it just ticks boxes, I would say don't make the movie. I have no idea. I have an idea why Eric Popper made his film. I think Utoya, July 22, the Eric Popper film, made this film to depict the trauma of the people who were there, to basically tell the story of the dead and the survivors. It's fictionalized, but it feels immediate. It feels honest. It feels horrible in many ways. I think I said last time that with the Norwegian film, I felt sad, I felt angry, and I felt numbed. I had strong reactions, as I think I should. I'm not sure I saw the point in generating those reactions as the film did, but it created reaction. My reactions with Paul Greengrass's 22nd of July were, how long is this going on for? Is it going on for much longer? Is it another hour? This is kind of boring. Are they going to do this now? Oh, no. And now he's going to have a speech. Okay. And mm-hmm. there were several lines where before the characters said the lines, I knew, and now they're going to say this because that's the most predictable thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're going to say that. And those lines came. It's ironic in a horrible way, but as I said, Utøya, July 22nd, the Norwegian film, it fictionalized. None of the characters shown on screen were real. They were composites of what the survivors said, what was reconstructed by the police. You didn't have the actual people. You had versions of them. You had a kind of synthesis or a condensation of the people on the island. 22nd of July actually takes real people who really existed, survivors, perpetrators, lawyers, and not a single one of them feels like a real person to me. They all feel like people in films. And I think that in itself to me says that Paul Greengrass didn't have a good idea what to do with this film.
Yeah.
And what came out was the lowest common denominator version. Paul Greengrass, I think he's got two broad strands of filmmaking. He's got action thrillers starring Matt Damon, and quite a few of those I actually quite like. I think he is a very competent craftsman when he's making a film that entertains and excites, but doesn't need to have anything to say. And he's got his real-life dramatizations. He had United 93, the 2006 film about one of the planes hijacked on 9/11. He had Bloody Sunday, which was a 2002 film about a 1972 massacre in Derry, Northern Ireland. He had Captain Phillips about, again, real-life story, real-life dramatization about a sea captain who's hijacked, right, by Somali pirates. And I actually thought all of those films succeeded more or less. I think United 93, I didn't think was a brilliant film, but it was better than I expected. I really think that 22nd of July is by far the weakest of these films. It is just so painfully generic. Even though, you know, it tries to go for a kind of Hollywood realism, it tries to look also documentary, but I think it fails in that. And it fails most obviously in, yes, Greengrass works with Norwegian actors, and I think the actors are, by and large, they're okay, even good. But he has them all speaking in English, which means that you're listening to Norwegians speaking English with Norwegian accents. Now, Norwegians, like most Nordic people, have a very high standard of English. But still, you have people talking in the language that's not their own with accents. That's already pretty iffy if you're trying to do historical drama, usually. You know, all these Nazis that speak English with German accents and the French that speak English with French accents. It all feels slightly comedic or dumb. In this film, if he wanted to make this realistic and documentary, have them speak in Norwegian. I listened to a review by Mark Kermode, the English film critic, where he mentioned that in an interview, Paul Greengrass said he had to make this film in English because he doesn't speak Norwegian. And my thought was just, then don't bloody make the film. Get someone else to make the film. I think any attempts at realism in the film are half-hearted. Any attempts at political comment in the film are half-hearted at best. It's bland, it's safe, it's generic. And I think it's unfortunately, there isn't a good word for this in English. In German, you can talk about Betroffenheitskino, which roughly translates into a cinema of shock and dismay. But actually, that is too strong. Betroffenheit is kind of, you kind of feel for the people involved. You kind of feel sad about things, but it's all kind of, it's all at a distance. You know, you read in the newspaper that 200 people died in a tsunami. And of course you're sad and you turn the page and you've forgotten it all. That's what this feels like to me. It doesn't feel to me like there's any strong passion or feeling about what happened. And with Erik Poppe, there is strong feeling. There is passion. There are risks. You can accuse that film of showing things that shouldn't be shown, but he doesn't hold back. He says, and we're going to do this. And he does it with commitment, with honesty. Greengrass feels like he didn't have anything else to do. So, you know, hey, what he usually does is real life dramatizations. It's just been an atrocity. Let's make a film.
I think Greengrass holds back. You don't see it, but he holds back. I think I realized that most when I watched, I think it's Breivik's mother. A policeman interviews her, and then the policeman is about to leave, and then the mother says something interesting, and I thought, okay, hold the camera, ask her some more. I wanted to go on. I don't remember the line, But I wanted the policeman to close the door again, go back into the living room and ask her some more.
Exactly.
The movie cuts away at the moment where the character becomes its most interesting.
Exactly. I remember the line, not exactly, but it's basically just as the policeman leaves, the mother says, "He's not completely wrong though, is he?
Yeah.
It's not like it used
exactly,
to be."
Exactly, that was it.
And I also thought that that, for me, is perhaps the one interesting and relevant line in this whole film.
Yeah.
Because I think that's what I said last time around about the decontextualization and the depoliticization of the other film, that it just has a caption at the end about, you know, the rise of right-wing extremists, yada, yada, yada. And in this one, I think it is so important to show that Breivik was not just a single crazy person. I'm not a psychologist, but of course his brand of action and thinking is extreme. But there is a continuum from there to far-right parties to the right-wing mainstream. And I think the right-wing mainstream has become more and more radical, more and more, well, having the kind of reactions that would probably say he shouldn't have killed all those kids, but he has a point. You find those kind of reactions more and more, and not just in Norway, in Europe, in America, throughout the world. And Breivik is a symptom of that. And if there is just 1 5-second line alluding to that, and the rest is well-meaning blandness, I find that cowardly.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I even realized just the other day that the one thing I remember most from Breivik as he's portrayed in the movie is that he looks uncannily like Chris Evans. And if that's the number one thing you remember from a performance, which has nothing to do with the performance itself, such a movie is in trouble. I mean, he is one of the main characters in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then doesn't do anything. It's so expertly and slickly done that it's disposable, that it's sort of forgettable.
Exactly.
And I also had a strong reaction to the two kids, the young, blonde, 17-year-old guy who finally takes the stand. I don't remember his name.
Villars, I think his name is. I probably butcher the pronunciation.
Mm-hmm. Him, who is white and male, and then they give him a counterpart, a woman of non-Nordic, non-Norwegian, non-Swedish background. And I thought, okay, wow. You know, Norway, Sweden, even Finland, all countries of immigration. Let's put two minorities together and let's give him a girl and with non-Swedish background, two minorities in one. I mean, it upset me that those cliches were fulfilled that way. The main protagonist, he has to be male, you know. The main victim, we have to see it through the eyes of a young, blonde, male guy. But in order to sort of even half satisfy the focus groups and whatnot, you have to give him a girl with immigrant background.
Mm-hmm.
It's too easy. I think we're letting off the movie too easily in a way. Me more than you.
Probably the defense would be, well, you know, they really existed. That constellation is true to life, but it was still picked.
Yeah.
I mean, there were many more survivors. They picked that one specifically because of the story they wanted to tell and the message they wanted to send. So it was a conscious choice. They definitely can't hide behind the, well, it's, you know, true to life.
Yeah.
Because there's still choices involved, and they made safe choices, and they made boring choices, and they made neutral and timid choices. I think Greengrass's background is in journalism, but I have to say that even as journalism, I would not rate this film. I think you can almost get more out of reading a couple of Wikipedia pages, and it feels like you turn a Wikipedia page into a TV movie.
Yeah.
The main character, I don't want to blame the actor, because I think the actor does relatively well as you can if you're speaking in a language that's not your own, and you have to basically always speak that language with an accent to signify actually you're speaking in Norwegian. But the story that he's given, even if it is true to life to some extent, is so predictable, so generic. I mean, you basically have the horrible thing that happens at the beginning. He's traumatized. He's at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And then he has to basically fight his way back up again, back to life, back to hope. And there's going to be a triumph, or kind of a bittersweet triumph in the end, where you see he has made it back again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exactly, if you asked 100 people what kind of a story should you tell with that kind of premise, that would be exactly the story you'd come up with.
Yeah.
It has exactly the beats you expect. And I mean, for heaven's sake, it has a training montage. It has a sequence where, and of course it's not played to Eye of the Tiger or anything. It's tastefully done, but it still is a bloody training montage. Mm-hmm. How much more generic can you get? It's just, if I didn't know any better, I would say that Paul Greengrass is not a human being. He's an AI, a deep learning computer program that's watched tons and tons and tons of Hollywood films. And then it's fed with a couple of variables and spits out this film.
Mm-hmm.
And it's surprising that it does it so competently. But no, I found it aggravating. My wife used the word insulting, and I would agree with her. It's insulting to make a film so mediocre about something like this. Because I really think that either you've got something to say and then you say it with conviction, and you take risks doing so,
mm-hmm.
or don't do it.
Yeah.
It's a kind of movie that you might have on the back of a cereal package. It's a kind of movie that you might get for free on DVD yeah. with your Sunday newspaper. It's a kind of movie about Utoya that you can show your grandparents yeah. and your uncle and aunt and your grandchildren. And it's not going to offend anyone. It's not going to shock anyone. It's not going to do anything to anyone other than having them nod for 5 minutes afterwards and say, yeah, that was really bad, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. That's eerie that you should mention that, because I was just thinking, you know, they could give away the DVD or the Blu-ray free at the back of a book called The 10 Biggest Massacres in the 21st Century.
Collect them all, exactly.
Time Life. Does Time Life still exist? I have no idea. But some kind of cheap compilation of horrific stuff.
Mm-hmm. And it could have been much worse. It could have been done incompetently, but I think in a way that it was done very competently by a craftsman who knows what he's doing makes it more insulting because you should be able to expect more. I think he did better with Captain Phillips. He did better with Bloody Sunday, even United 93, which I think has its issues. And I'm also not sure quite why it exists.
Mm.
It does better. I think United 93 is probably a bit closer to Utøya, July 22nd, the Norwegian film, in terms of what it does and how engaged it is, how passionate it is about its subject. 22nd of July, no. I would rather recommend Utøya, July 22nd, a film that I found problematic and where I'm not quite sure what its purpose is, as the film about Utøya. I think it needs to be complemented with context, perhaps with documentaries, with articles, but it does something, and it does something very, very well.
Yeah, it does.
Greengrass does many things, and he does none of them particularly well. He doesn't do them badly either. He just does them middle of the road.
Yeah.
It's such a neutral film, for want of a better word, about a topic where neutrality is insulting.
I was just going to say that there is probably no unproblematic film about Utøya, and there shouldn't be. When you want to do an unproblematic film about Utøya, you get a Greengrass film, you know?
Exactly.
Maybe. And unproblematic in that case is very close to, as you said, insulting.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think of insulting when I watched the movie, but I think you're right. I can see what you mean. I think that there were the survivors actually like the Poppe film much better than Greengrass. The Greengrass was heavily criticized that they left out stuff. But I think maybe there's a 3.5-hour version of the Greengrass movie, which might not be an improvement at all. If it's playing that safe, I don't think they cut out all the controversial stuff. What would there be to leave? You know, what's more controversial than a guy shooting kids on an island?
Yeah.
I have no idea.
I do kind of wonder if I'd seen the films the other way around, if I'd first seen the Paul Greengrass film and then the Erik Poppe film, my reaction might be a bit different. I don't think it would be entirely different. But I remember, for instance, I think you talked about this with Poppe's film of the massacre, that sometimes the silences, the moments when there are no shots, where you have no idea, where is this person? Is it just one person? Is it many people? Is the shooting going to start again? Is it going to be closer? The tension there is masterful, and it's horrible even for the people sitting in the audience.
Yeah.
I found Poppe's film very difficult to watch. I found the depiction of the actual massacre in Paul Greengrass' film comparably easy to watch because it felt like the it felt like the Reader's Digest version of the massacre. It felt like, let's make this suitable for grannies and aunts and uncles version of the massacre. So there was none of that tension. There might have been more of the tension if I hadn't seen another much more masterful filmic depiction of it before. But even if not, I really think that it was the TV movie version of the massacre. And I think you don't have to show gratuitous violence. You don't have to necessarily show much blood or anything. You don't have to actively show people being shot. But you have to make it count. You have to make the audience feel something. Otherwise, they might really just as well read the Wikipedia entry. And actually, I find that that had more of an impact on me than Greengrass depiction of the massacre.
So,
it's funny. I had massive issues with the first film, which I discussed last time around. But this one really has made me reevaluate what Utoya, July 22nd, Eric Bopper's film does. Mm-hmm. And it's the much, much better film. I think I can safely say that.
I think so too, yeah. I mean, neither of them compels me to go to the kitchen and make a big bowl of popcorn on a Saturday night. But I won't watch The Greengrass again because it's there's nothing there that I find worthy of a second viewing. It's just, it's procedural. It ticks all the boxes and that's it. The Poppy movie it's dense, it's claustrophobic, it's hard to watch. Sometimes it's exactly what I want to see. There might be a time where I'm going to revisit the Eric Poppy movie, but not regularly. Mm-hmm. Thank God I'm not in a regular mood to watch that kind of movie. There are people who can't stand those ordeal movies, you know, where the tension is about one situation for 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. Not everybody's built the same. Not everybody has the same sensibilities. And that's, of course, a huge plus. But to me, such movies need to be made. And it's also, the Poppy movie is also, in a very rock bottom way, it's also very cinematic. An account of the Eric Poppy movie would do something completely different.
Yeah, exactly. I was actually just thinking that if you read the summary of the Poppy movie on Wikipedia, you have no idea what it's like to watch the Eric Poppy movie. Exactly. If you read the same summary about Greengrass film on Wikipedia, the summary basically tells you everything that the film tells you. Mm-hmm. So you can skip the film.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is one of the harshest things you can say about the movie.
Skipping it, yeah.
Don't watch the film, just read the Wikipedia summary.
That's a death sentence for a movie, yeah.
I think this probably, I don't know, if we now go on talking about Greengrass movie, I don't think we're going to say anything nicer about it. So
no,
perhaps
I don't
we should
think so.
Let
no.
it rest at this point.
Yeah. I'm kind of glad we did a two-parter in a way because we can compare stuff. Yeah. Utoya, the Greengrass movie is on Netflix. The Poppy one was at the cinema. I don't know whether it's already available on DVD or Blu-ray. It's always, you know, history repeats itself. The better movies are harder to find. The Poppy movie, you will have to wait until it's out on DVD. And Greengrass, the lesser movie, is on Netflix. You can go and watch it immediately, right after you've listened to the podcast. Okay, it's still foggy outside. It was great talking to you for another hour. Thanks a lot for the discussion. To you, Matt, thanks a lot for our listeners. We hope you've enjoyed this program and we'll be back in a month's time. Take care, watch good movies, read good books, and bye-bye.
Absolutely. And a quick shout out to our friend, listener, and critic, Julie, who's given us some great feedback on our podcast. And we're hoping to actually work on tweaking certain things based on what she's told us. Thanks a lot for that. Thanks to all of you out there. Have a good autumn. And hear you again in a month's time. Bye.
Bye-bye.